There's a story told of two young fish swimming in the ocean one morning, and they pass by an older fish who says to them, "Good morning, boys," and they respond, "Good morning, sir." He then says to them, "How's the water today?" And they mumble something and keep on swimming, and then one of the young fish turns to the other and says, "What's water?" I always say that we really don't know anything about our own family until we get married, until we're thrown into the ocean of another family dynamic. Each family has a particular and unique dynamic in all sorts of ways. But as we grow up, it's just the water that's all around us. It's so much all around us that we don't even necessarily see it. It's just the unseen reality of our lives. In this episode, we continue the journey of exploring your childhood development by looking at the versions and the different components of family systems that exist and trying to break them down to understand them, all with the hope and the goal of strengthening our capacity for deeper connection to those we love most. This episode is sponsored by an online fitness program called Jump Into Shape. Jump Into Shape has really taken off recently. I myself tried one of their workouts, one of their 20-minute workouts, and can attest to having had a great experience. They have a wide range of programs and videos for people at all levels and with all sorts of different particular needs in terms of how much time you have or don't have. I think they have 7-minute workouts. That really caught my attention. What equipment you have or don't have. They make it really accessible and affordable to stay in shape and feel really good about yourself. Check it out. They have a free 30-day trial going right now for unlimited access to live and on-demand classes. You can access your 30-day free trial at www.jumpintoshape.fun/freemonth. Again, that's jumpintoshape.fun/freemonth. Thanks so much for listening and hope you enjoy this episode. Relationships are too important and too challenging to take for granted. Welcome to The Attached Life, where we explore the magic and the madness of our most meaningful relationships. Our first two episodes in this series essentially laid the groundwork for the two most foundational aspects that make up our development as human beings. The first being our need for closeness, our need to feel felt, to have our existence confirmed and valued and celebrated as it arrives in this world. We need to feel that those around us, that people in our lives care about us, see us, and know us. And the second pillar or fundamental need that we have is the need for space, for individuality, for people to allow us to be us, to not be too close in the sense that they deprive us of our autonomy, of our ability to have unique preferences, particular needs and wants, and personality. And in those two different aspects, the need for closeness and the need for space, the need for merging with others and yet individuating from others, those are really the two pillars that make up the development of the rest of our lives. And the whole game that continues from that point on is, how do we balance those two things? And how do we get that right for ourselves and others to allow for closeness and relationship, which also allows for space and individuality? Years ago, I came across a model for family systems that for me was really enlightening and incredibly helpful for developing self-understanding and helping clients and other people develop self-understanding of how they developed and how their family system contributed to their development in terms of how these two different foundational aspects, closeness and individuation, played out in their family system as they grew up. And as we've been doing, when we understand that, we can then work with the parts of ourselves that need to be plucked out of whatever areas of struggle or deficiency or weakness they were in and help them be nurtured to strength, whether it's the need for more closeness or it's the need for more space, the need to be cared for more or the need to be more autonomous. So The family system that I'm referring to was made by someone named David Olson. And he came up with something called the Circumplex Family Systems Model. So the Circumplex Model for short. And what he did was really simple, but very brilliant and incredibly insightful. What he did was he made an x-axis and a y-axis, a vertical and a horizontal. So the vertical axis is made up of the aspect of the family system with regards to how flexible or how rigid the family is. And he gives essentially a sliding scale, a spectrum, from a range of rigid to chaotic. And so the spectrum goes in his language as follows. On one extreme, you have rigid, and this is the bottom, let's say, of the vertical axis, the vertical scale. So rigid refers to the rules and the roles in the family system. So how rigid are we about expectations, about rules, about what we foresee as the future profession of our children, the future religiosity of our children, the beliefs of our family, the values of our family, the roles that each of us play in our family, the role that mom plays, the role that dad plays, the role that the older brother plays, the role that the younger sibling plays, that each person plays, where we go, when we do it, how we do it, what we're doing, what we believe in, what's important to us, when there is this consequence or this punishment, when there's this reward or that reward, etc. So things of that nature, how adaptable are we? How rigid are we? So on one end of that spectrum, you have a family system that is extremely rigid, which means that, let's say, for example, no matter what, you must do X. And when you do X, you must do it in this particular way. Mom is always expected to do something, whatever that might be, regardless of what's going on, what may have just happened, what's happening for her, what she's feeling, what she's going through. Dad is always expected to do something and not do something else, regardless of the context or the situation. The family expectation is that we always do this, whatever it may be. On the flip side, you have, on the other end of that spectrum, chaotic, which means that there are no rules, no roles. Who's making dinner tonight? No one knows. Is there dinner tonight? No one knows. It might just be picked up. It might not be. It might be left. It might be open the fridge and see what you can find. What are we doing when we have free time at home? Who does what? What's allowed? What's not allowed? Are we allowed to go to this place, to go to that place? Am I allowed to walk here? Am I not allowed to? Everything is just open-ended. Things are essentially chaotic. There's no clarity and structure to who does what, how it's done, or anything of that nature. There's complete chaos. Those are the two extremes of that spectrum, rigid and chaotic. In the middle sections, closer to rigid, you have what Olson called structured, which means that you have a family that has more clarity on rules and roles, not so much flexibility. There is a clear setup and a clear order. Dinner always takes place at a certain time or approximately a certain time, and there's a certain kind of routine to the system. There's clear bedtimes. There's a clear distribution of responsibilities. But within that structure, there is room for adaptability to unique circumstances that arise. And we can adjust when something is different, when something is going on. Children are expected to perform in a certain way and follow a certain path, and there is clarity and expectation around that. However, at the same time, there's also an understanding that there can be kids that can be different, kids that might grow up in a different way, that might have different needs, might have different interests, etc. Although keeping to that general path that's set in this family. So you have structured, which is a notch over from rigid. Then also in the middle, but closer to the chaotic side, you have what he calls flexible, which means that fundamentally we're more flexible, but we have structure. So things are kind of loose in the way that the family runs. There isn't necessarily a clear, specific dinner time or dinner routine, but there is a clarity of there will be dinner, there will be a balanced meal, there will be whatever it might be. And there's generally a sense of who's doing what. There might be some more options, but the distribution and division of responsibility and roles has a certain flow to it, even if it's more flexible and more fluid. But there is kind of a boundary on either side of that. It's not in complete chaos. So that's one scale. And what Olson points out is, and this is already known from before his work, and I'll show you soon what the novelty of what he did was, but this is already known, is that on either side of that extreme, if we have rigidity or we have chaos, that's going to lead to results that are not amazing for child development. Anywhere in the middle, from structured to flexible, is a good place to be. There's not an exact sweet spot that a person needs to be at exactly that middle point. There are pros and cons to being more structured, pros and cons to being more flexible, but anywhere in that middle range is a healthy place to be versus either extreme of the chaos or the rigidity. Another example of this might be with regards to consequences or punishments within a family. Is there rigidity around that in the sense that there's a clear, always, no matter what kind of punishment that takes place, and there's no regard for unique circumstance, for anything that may have been an extenuating situation or whatever may have been going on. There's just a automatic punishment of a certain nature. On the flip side, you have chaos might look like either having no punishments ever, and the children can essentially just do whatever they want with no consequences. Or chaos can be that there are punishments, but the punishments are very erratic and inconsistent, and they may be very extreme, but then not really carried out. Or they may be sometimes and not others, for some kids and not all kids, etc. Versus flexible, the middle range from flexible to structured, the rules have a certain consistency and structure to them, but yet at the same time, adaptability and understanding and attunement to the details of each situation while still allowing for stability and consistency. So that's one scale. The horizontal scale in Olson's model is not about rules and roles and adaptability, but about the family cohesion. How connected, how close of a family unit is there? So on one extreme, you have disengaged. Disengaged meaning that the parents and the family for one another are essentially disengaged. They're not really close to one another. They're not emotionally close to one another. They don't really spend time together. And if they do spend time together, it's more mechanical. It's more activity. It's not really a togetherness that is felt or that is experienced. There's not really an understanding or an attunement or a connection of one person's inner world to another person's inner world. There's kind of a certain invisibility that people feel. There is a aloofness, aloneness, isolation, even if they may be surrounded by other people. And sometimes in the extreme, they really may just be alone. They might be coming home to an empty house. There may not be other people around them. They may not be asked how their day was on a consistent, in any kind of consistent way. They may not be tuned into as to what they might be going through or experiencing, what their likes and wants and preferences and personality is made up of. They are just fundamentally alone. There's a disengagement in the family system. On the other extreme, with regard to cohesion, you have what he calls enmeshed, which is when you have a family system that is so close that it's not really closeness, it's really a kind of suffocation. It's a swallowing up of the other. So when the parents are so involved, so enmeshed in the child, that the child doesn't really get to be their own person. They essentially become a vicarious life of the parent. They become an extended limb of the parent. They become the parent's second chance at life, or they become the parent's caretaker. They just essentially become an appendage to the parent, and they do not have the opportunity to feel that they're seen or that they have a personality or a personhood or an individuated sense of self in any real substantive way. So those are the two extremes, the disengaged and enmeshed. And once again, we have in the middle two different versions. Closer to the disengaged side, you have what he calls separated, which means that there is a sense of being known by other. There is a sense of connection, but there's a high level of of autonomy, of individuality, of doing things for oneself, of being able to take care of oneself, of being empowered to be your own person, to grow up with a sense of responsibility, a sense of belief in oneself and one's capacity to do and to take care of things on their own. Yet there is a sense of being part of a system, being part of a family, knowing that there are people that if you need and if you come to a situation where you're at your limit or you're at the point where you can't take care of something yourself, there are people there that care about you. There are people there that you can turn to. You are not completely alone. You have who to turn towards. Next to that, closer to the enmeshed side, but still in the middle section, is what he calls connected, which means that we experience a real sense of connection, a real deep sense of warmth, of being one, of being cared for, of being nurtured, of being seen, and that is a staple of the family experience, that there's a real deep sense of connection. So just like on the adaptability scale, with the cohesion scale, the problem is the extremes. Anywhere in that middle section from separated to connected is a great place to be, is a healthy place to be, and different families can do that in different ways. The problem is when we have one extreme or the other extreme of disengaged or enmeshed. Now, what Olson does that is so interesting is that he puts these two scales together, and he shows how when they become combined with one another, that's where we fall into real challenges in our personal development throughout our lives based on our family environments. So what that means is if you imagine these two scales, one as vertical and one as horizontal, and you think about how they're going to overlap with each other, what that means is that you can have a combination of disengaged on the relationship level and chaotic on the rules and roles level. Alternatively, you can have disengaged and rigid. Similarly, you can have enmeshed and chaotic or enmeshed and rigid. And I'll try and go through examples of each of these in a moment. But the point is that if you have extremes on both of these scales and they become combined, that's where a lot of our more deeply held negative beliefs about self and maladaptive patterns that are kind of just holding on to us throughout our lives are developed. Because if you grow up in an environment that is chaotically disengaged or rigidly disengaged or chaotically enmeshed or rigidly enmeshed, that combination is going to lead to a variety of deep and foundational challenges in the development of who we are. So you can imagine a variety of ways that these combinations can go, and there's no one set path for how it's going to affect a person. But there are some typical patterns or paths that the development goes down based on these different family system characteristics. So let me go through each of the problem categories and give one example of what I've found to be a typical outcome of what that looks like. And again, when I describe these things, I typically do so in an extreme. I formulate the extreme version of it to help try and create clarity around the concept. Of course, for many, many people, there are more subtle versions of these things. For some people, for a decent amount of people, there really are the extreme versions of these things. But it's not unique or exclusive to the extreme. All these things can exist on a spectrum. But for the sake of clarity of bringing out the concept, I'm going to use some of the more intense cases or individuals that I've had the opportunity to work with to kind of paint a picture of how this plays itself out. So if we look at the category of a family system that is rigid in its rules and roles and expectations and is also enmeshed in its relationships, what that looks like in childhood is, for example, a client of mine that we are going to call Todd. So Todd grew up, and I'm changing some details here, Todd grew up in a home that was both rigid and enmeshed, rigidly enmeshed, which means that the rules and roles and expectations were set in stone. with little to no flexibility. So there was an exact time for dinner every night. There was an exact order to how that takes place. And if anything is altered or done differently about that, it is noticed because of the enmeshment. It's noticed, and it is also commented on and criticized. And it's done so in a very shaming way. It's done so in a way of, that's not how we do this. Is that how you talk? Is that how you hold your fork? Is that how you sit at the table? Is that how you clear your plate? Etc. And so the constant barrage of this comment, this running commentary, so to speak, on what you're doing. When you get home, you have to put your bag exactly here, and if it's slightly amiss or slightly different than the way it's supposed to be, it's going to be commented on when you have new shoes that you just got. We're all worried about how quickly you're going to ruin them, and so we're constantly commenting on that. And when you hang up your pants, you have to make sure to do it in a certain way so that it's on the crease, so that it's not going to have to get sent to the dry cleaners an extra time. And of course, all these things in a vacuum sound relatively normal, but when there's the constant running commentary, there's this rigidity around exactly how we do things, and there can never be an exception to that rule. So that's always going on. And the enmeshment means that we're always in your face about it. We're always present to it. So it's not just a theoretical value. It's not just a kind of family belief that we hold, but there's an enmeshment with it. We are constantly present about that. You can imagine, it's even just to talk about it, it feels almost exhausting to experience that. And that's going to run itself in the context of grades and school and religiosity and how you daven. And I'm thinking of a different individual now, and the parent having expectations of the child, even as a young child, to wake up by a certain time to go to davening at a early time in the day, and to say certain parts of the davening at a certain volume and with a certain intensity, and being extremely on top of that and critical of that. And if the milk is left out for a little bit too long, we're all nervous and anxious about that. And so there's all this rigidity and enmeshment. I can imagine another situation of a client whose father wanted him to get into a certain yeshiva that he considered to be the right yeshiva, the best yeshiva, and clearly was not the right yeshiva for this individual. And the father had his son repeat a grade so that he could go to this yeshiva, which of course still wasn't the right place for him, but therefore lost all his, you know, lost his social group, etc. And you can imagine all sorts of other things. This is coming from a rigid set of expectations, a rigid set of rules, a rigid set of routines, and an enmeshment in how those rules, roles, and expectations play out. And in that experience, you can imagine a person growing up, and I'm going back to Todd now, as growing up and coming out of that system, chronically self-criticizing. So in his head now, all of that running commentary, all of that criticism, all of that shaming tone is constantly running because it's everything he lived with for so many years. His only way to turn it off, his only way to find some peace and some quiet is to sometimes disengage from all the things that he actually values in his life and engage in what, as a teenager, he considered to be more rebellious activities, which then persist into adulthood, even though he doesn't want to. But you can understand why, because he needed a place to escape from all of that. And it creates a kind of chronic need to be secretive about things, even things that don't need to be secretive. But it's just, I don't want to be seen, because there's almost an assumption that if I'm seen, I will be criticized. And so there's a impulsive need to not engage and not show myself, not show my cards, not talk about even just getting home and hearing, how was your day? I don't want to answer that because I don't want to hear a comment about it. I don't want to hear a criticism about it. So there's the chronic self-criticizing in my own head, and there's the assumption of criticism from anyone who's going to see me. And so there's a need to hide, and there's a constant need of putting myself down, living with a kind of really suffocated sense of self and a very shamed version or self-identity. So that's an example of what it looks like to have a rigidly enmeshed family system. Moving to a second example now of what rigidly disengaged will look like. So in the rigid disengagement, you don't have that kind of in-your-face commentary and criticism that we had in the rigid enmeshment. Instead, what you have typically is a rigidity not so much about the day-to-day details of the way the child is holding their fork or the way the place they put their backpack or whatever it might be, but it's usually more a rigidity around what we value in our family, what we see as being success. So oftentimes that's going to have to do a lot more with skills, such as being smart or intellectual, or being successful financially and making a lot of money, or being extremely presentable in terms of how you look and dressing extremely well, or having a really good reputation, things of that nature, or certain religious expectations of being a certain way religiously. There's going to be more of a rigidity, not about the details of the day-to-day activities, but more about who you become and how you live your life in a more broad way. Is there a kind of expectation that you're going to be the captain of the varsity basketball team? Or there's an expectation that you are going to get into an Ivy League school or get into a certain top-notch yeshiva or seminary or whatever it may be. And that is going to now be paired with a relational disengagement in the rigidly disengaged family system, meaning that while there's these very rigid, broad expectations, but relationally, there's disengagement. So the parents are perhaps very distant because they're consumed by their work, or they're consumed by community involvement or philanthropy or volunteering or taking care of things or having a social life or whatever it may be that they're very engaged in and disengaged from their family and from their children relationally. So now the child is growing up in an environment where there's all these expectations for certain performance and certain skills, but they're not really getting much emotional nurturance from the parents. And so what typically happens, and to give an example of a client here, let's say we'll call him Matt, what he showed up with in the context of my office was a very compulsive need to respond to his work, whether that's through email or phone call or whatever it is, but a kind of compulsive level of doing that to the point where he felt that he really struggled to be present to his family or to whatever other behaviors or activities he wanted to be involved in. Another client, as an example of the same kind of a thing, really became consumed by a need for reassurance from others about his intellectual prowess, his intellectual sophistication, and became completely self-identified with that. And when he felt that he was the smartest person in the room and that was being seen, he felt good. But anytime he wasn't being seen for that, or actually wasn't the smartest person in the room, was deeply insecure. So much so that, of course, even when he was seen as the smartest person in the room, he was still insecure because it was fundamentally insecure because of how fragile that is, that at any moment that could be lost. And this is the typical result, I find, the typical result of a rigidly disengaged system. Because what the child does in that environment that we described is the child will latch on to a particular value or talent or skill or performance that he or she is able to see that the parents and the family system values. And they're not getting personal emotional nurturance. They're not being seen for who they are. So the only thing they can do is identify with that performance in the hope that, well, if my family really, really values being the best athlete or being the best at school or being the best looking or the best dressed or the wealthiest, if I can do that, well, now I'll have my family's approval. So I become consumed by the need to do that. So if we think of that client I mentioned about the compulsive need to answer at work, well, he became really identified with being a productive person because his family's rigidity was around being productive. We don't play video games in our family. We read books. We do things. We volunteer in our community, which of course sounds like a nice thing, but if that's overly rigid, then what ends up happening is that now this individual develops this need to be productive compulsively to a point where it's actually maladaptive and counterproductive in his life. Similarly, the individual with the intellect, his family system, what they valued was being intellectual. So the father was very distant relationally because he was always involved in some philosophical conversation with peers or involved in some community project, and he was kind of the smartest person in the room, whatever it may be. And so this child developed this sense that, well, the only way that I can have value is if I am also deeply smart and the smartest person around me. So that's an example of what it looks like to have the rigid disengagement, is the over-identification with a particular skill or a particular performance to the point where it becomes compromising of other values and other aspects of a person's life. If we move over to the other side of these scales, we then move over into what's called chaotically disengaged. So again, this is going to mean kind of the opposite of the rigidity we spoke about. So you have the family where there are no clear rules, no clear roles, no clear expectations. It's really chaos. And when that's combined with disengagement, what you have is really, actually in that sense, really more simple because the chaos and the disengagement go together. The parents are totally just not present. And so there are no rules, no roles, no expectations, and there are no relationships. So one client that I've worked with who grew up in this kind of a system developed really a sense of disregard for any sort of impact on other people. He really essentially just developed this capacity to do anything and feel that anything he wanted to do was justified because essentially growing up in that environment, it's almost like I'm the king of the castle, king of the world. There are no rules, no roles, no expectations. No one cares what I do, and no one's even really present to anything. What's really interesting, by the way, is that this individual in particular that I'm thinking of, his parents actually expressed a lot of love, but their love was so unconditional that it actually became, in a sense, relatively meaningless. I don't want to say meaningless because any love that a person gets, we want to find the value in, but to a certain degree became meaningless because, you know, we often think about, and in our society, what's usually spoken about more is when the love is overly conditional, then the child doesn't truly feel loved. But the truth is the flip side is also true, because if I feel unconditionally loved to the extent where you don't even care what I do, you don't care if I break the rules. I was told by my father explicitly, thinking of this client, that, yeah, do whatever you want, just don't get caught. And I saw my father or heard him say that, you know, he's going to do whatever he wants, hoping he just, as long as he doesn't get caught, you know, cheating on taxes or whatever it may be, that's the rule of the game. And so now what I start to perceive about myself is that what I do really doesn't matter to my parents. They really don't care. There is no sense of I'm important, that my actions are significant, or that my actions matter, because there don't seem to be any consequences of my actions. I could do the greatest thing in the world, and they'll say they love me, and I can do the absolute worst thing in the world, and they'll say the exact same thing, and look at me in the exact same way, and there will be no difference. So they were disengaged while at the same time paying lip service to saying all sorts of very lovey type things, but really we're deeply disengaged, and it was a chaotic household. And what that developed into was a person who was living in a marriage, but really living a double life, living with a whole host of secrets and living a very dark double life, a disregard for others, a disregard for any consequences, any rules, any expectations. As long as I can get away with anything, anything is fine. what's interesting about that is that deep beneath or deep within that is actually the hope that if I do something bad enough, maybe someone will actually care. Because I just want to know, is anyone out there? Does anyone care? Do I matter at all? Will I ever matter? Is there anything I can do that will make a difference? So there's this complete disregard for others, which is really on a deep level a search for hoping that someone actually cares about me. But there's this very callous, very unempathetic way of living, not being able to see that other people matter or that my actions have consequences upon others. And that can often lead to a certain personality with a lot of secrets, a kind of a double life. And this brings us to the fourth category, the chaotically enmeshed category. And when I think of chaotically enmeshed, I often think of examples of clients I've worked with who are what we sometimes refer to as parentified children. So chaotically enmeshed means that the household functions in a very chaotic way. The parents really do not have a handle on things, but the system is very enmeshed. So the parents don't know how to get things together, but they're very present and they're very needy. So now the child feels a certain level of responsibility to take care of things. My parents can't get their act together, but they're not disengaged. They're right here, but they're reacting more negatively to what happened to me at school today than I am. This is like clients who I've worked with who don't want to tell their parents about something that happened that they need help with because they feel that their parents are going to have more of a emotional dysregulation than they themselves will, and they don't want to have to deal with taking care of their parents. They want it to be helped. But now if I tell my mother and she's going to react so strongly, I'm going to have to worry about her. I don't want to have to worry about her. Or my parents, their own battles or fights or different issues with each other come up in a way that it creates a very confusing structure in terms of what the roles are and who's doing what. So it creates this chaos, but it's enmeshed in the sense that it's all in my face. It's all here. I see all of it. So now I'm walking on eggshells. I'm constantly worrying, how are my parents doing? How is this being taken care of? How is that going? How is their relationship? How are the finances? How's mom doing? How's she dealing with this or coping with that or et cetera, all those kinds of things. And now you have this child who actually really becomes the parent for his or her own children. The way that I find that that shows up in adults is people who have a very hard time with self-care, with doing what they need to do to keep themselves in a balanced, healthy place and in a regulated place. And people who sometimes actually do a lot of self-care, but it seems to perpetually never be satisfying. It never kind of hits the spot. They still never feel full in themselves. The tank never feels full for them. Alternatively, or in addition to that, what I often find the way that this shows up is people who are hypersensitive or hyperstimulated. What I mean by that, but by others around them, what I mean by that is that if you think about kind of an image that each of us as individuals has, so to speak, a bubble, kind of like a energy bubble around us that separates me from you. And we can allow other people's energy, we can allow other people's emotions or facial expressions or difficulties, challenges, joys, excitement. We can allow that into our bubble, but there's kind of this bubble that allows us to filter in what we take in and filter out what we don't want to take in, so that we're not overstimulated by an overload of sensory information and material that's happening around us all the time. Because there are things happening around us all the time. We walk down the street and we pass by 10 people, and those 10 people are each feeling and experiencing different things. Do we absorb all of that? So we don't, because we have this kind of sense of self that allows a filter to filter in and out what we take in and what we don't take in. People who grew up in that kind of chaotically enmeshed environment and become those parentified children often don't have that bubble, or it's a very compromised bubble. And so there isn't really a filter present. So they're oftentimes overly stimulated, overly sensitive to what's happening around them. So they're picking up on everyone else's energy. This, by the way, is often therapists, but that's a different story. So they're often really, really perceptive, overly perceptive to the point that it actually becomes, in the extreme, can become debilitating. And maybe not in the extreme, it's not debilitating, but it becomes taxing, it becomes burdensome, it becomes draining of their own energy, and it makes it very difficult for them to feel a sense of self and their ability to have their own regulation, because they're always taking in everyone else's stuff all the time. So all of that are some examples of how these different combinations play themselves out. The rigidly enmeshed, rigidly disengaged, chaotically disengaged, and chaotically enmeshed. Our goal here is for you to find yourself, possibly not in any of that. And if you don't identify with any of that, and you had any of those middle categories where we talked about structured to flexible in terms of the rules and roles, and separated to connected in terms of cohesion. And so what your family system would sound like would be flexibly separated or flexibly connected would be a great healthy middle place. Alternatively, structurally separated or structurally connected. All of that is great. And if that's where you find yourself, so you can celebrate that and pause the episode here. However, if you identify in the extreme or not in the extreme, in a subtle way, in a moderate way, or even in a mild way with any of the concepts that we just spoke about, what you want to do is find your inner child. Find your inner child who is still in that chaotically disengaged environment, or that chaotically enmeshed, or rigidly disengaged environment. And we want the adult you to go rescue that inner child who is still stuck in that environment and help him or her build a new environment. The adult you can find that inner child who at this moment may still be experiencing the world as if it is that old system, and help them update the system. Help them build the middle zones, the flexibility and the structure, the separation and the connectedness. Help that child see this world in a new way. Show them the life that you've developed. If you have a family of your own, if you have your own children, show them how you are parenting. Bring them into your family, your new family system, where you've created that healthier middle space. Invite the child to see that, to partake in that. Reparent that younger child. And so in the name of trying to do that, of trying to show this younger inner self a new environment, a new system, and what that can look like, and build that new experience, I want to just end this episode by sharing some examples of what the middle can look like. What does it look like to live in an environment and a family that functions with those middle qualities, the structure and flexibility, the separation and connectedness? In terms of parent-to-child interactions, one of my favorite examples of how this is done, and so many of the things that I've read as a parent for myself, sound so great in the books or the podcasts, but then when I try and use them, they seem to never really work. But this one actually really works, at least that's what I find. So there's a book called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. And in that book, what I found was that the author writes that the same way that the Jewish people accepted Hashem's commandments, accepted the Torah from God, when they said the words Na'aseh V'Nishma, and traditionally the way we understand Na'aseh V'Nishma means we will do and we will listen, means that the performance is first and then the explanation or the understanding comes afterwards. And so what this author writes is that that's a template for parenting. So very often as a parent, we have a situation where the child wants something and we give an answer or we give a directive to the child that they don't like, they don't want to listen to. So very often they will then respond by saying, but why? And when we answer that question, that answer, no matter what we say, is never satisfying to the child. And so then it just leads down a road of a battle and a power struggle, and it turns into the child getting more upset and the parent trying to explain themselves more, and then oftentimes the parent will give in, or it'll turn into the parent punishing the child, and it goes into a whole saga that anyone who is a parent here, I'm sure, can relate to or understand. What this book suggests is a Nasa Vinishma approach, which is some parents, and this is sometimes thought of as a more old school way, will take just the Nasa approach, meaning, I'm not giving you an explanation. I don't owe you an explanation. You have to do what I said. I'm the parent. You have to do what I said. And that's it. And it's over. That's the Nasa approach. New age parents often will take a Nishma approach. I'm only going to tell you to do things when I can explain it to you. You always deserve to know why. I'm going to tell you exactly the reason. And that is the Nishma approach, the understanding approach, versus the middle. So the Nasa in the extreme would be the rigid system. The Nishma in the extreme would be the chaotic system. The middle, where we have flexibility and structure, is what the Torah is teaching us of Nasa Vinishma means. When I tell my child to do something and they say why, I can say to them, first I need you to do it, and then I'll be happy to explain it to you if you want. So the example that this author gives is you're telling your child that she needs to leave a birthday party. And she says, but why? If you start explaining it to her, you're not going to get her anywhere. You're not going to help her. It's going to create chaos. If you just say, because we have to, and I said so. So you're creating this rigidity, and the child's going to be deeply frustrated and resentful. Versus, when you come to the car, I will tell you why. And the child says, no, but I don't want to come to the car. Why? And you say, when we go to the car, I will tell you why. And it really works. I actually find that sometimes I have to reinforce it before I say, when I tell you why, it's the conversation's going to be over. First, you have to do what I said, and then I'll tell you why, but only if you agree that once I tell you why, we're not going back and forth about it. And this approach really creates that middle, that balance. So that's one example of what the middle looks like, the Nasa Vinishma approach. A second example is when we have and when we can implement within one family system the possibility of different expectations for different children, or alternatively, different expectations even for the same children, but at different times. Allowing for that flexibility while still maintaining structure. There are expectations. It's not that expectations are out the window, but I can allow for different expectations from different children or even from the same children in different circumstance. If we're in a school night, if it's vacation, if I understand that the child was up very late the night before, if I understand the child's sick, if I understand the child just had a bad day or something happened, etc. So I have structure, but there's flexibility within that structure. To just go through a couple more quick hitters of these examples, being in the middle means that there is consistency in terms of the forms of discipline and punishment. Consistency, again, with the ability to have flexibility. A fourth is when the parent's interests do not have to be assumed to be the kid's interests. So the parent could have been the star basketball player, but does not assume that the child is going to even like basketball. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. The parent could be really smart and have been great at school, that may not be what the child's strength is. So the parents are not assuming or projecting what their talents, skills, and interests are on their children. A fifth is that the children don't need to know the parents' challenges. So when a child experiences the parents' challenge too much, that creates that enmeshment and that parentified child. Now, when a child does want to know something, does see something, asks about it. So they don't have to have all the information. It's often not appropriate or not right to give them details or the backstory of everything a parent is experiencing, etc. But that they're not shamed or just pushed away for asking, but they're given a honest, appropriate, proper response. Sometimes that response can simply be, you're right, there is something going on, but it's not something you need to know. It's not something that's good for you to know. Sometimes there can even be a little bit of information without saying too much, without saying what doesn't need to be said. But there's this balance of, on the one hand, they don't see or know too much of the parents' personal challenges or problems in ways that become enmeshing and entrapping for the child. And yet at the same time, the child's sensory system that picks up on things going on for the parents is respected and validated as being accurate, so the child can feel a sense of, I'm not crazy for thinking that I'm picking up on something. A final example, and I think this is a really important one, is that a sign of being in the middle with regards to these categories is that when a kid is in trouble, when they've done something wrong or something is going wrong, they know that they are actually afraid of their parent. That's a good sign. And yet they still want to turn to their parent because they know that in the end of the day, the parent will support them and the parent will be helpful to them and they want their parents' help. If you have one extreme or the other, there's something missing. Meaning, if you have a child who doesn't even feel afraid of the parent at all, they can tell them anything. Their parent actually bought them weed for their bar mitzvah and their uncle bought it and their parent knew about it. There's something about that that's chaotic and very, very unstable for the child. On the other side, when the child doesn't want to tell the parent that they got in deep trouble for something, something went really wrong and they actually really need help, they won't let anyone call their parents when they're actually, when they have alcohol poisoning and they're, you know, in trouble, or they're stuck at a party and the only people who can drive home are drunk and they don't want their parent to find out because their parent is going to be so angry and punish them so badly and they're so afraid to tell their parent that they actually then are stuck and make really bad decisions. That's the rigidity side of that spectrum. Somewhere in the middle is the child who is afraid of their parent and yet also knows that my parent is the person that I turn to when I'm in trouble. My parent is the person that I turn to when I'm in need. So with all these examples and many others that everyone can think about, we want to find our inner children, our inner self that may still be struggling with any of these kinds of systemic characteristics of the ways that we grew up in the very challenging attempt that all families need to engage to balance the pillars of child and human development that we started out with, namely closeness and space, togetherness and connection with individuation and personal autonomy. And so when we can identify where the weakness was for us in terms of those systems, we then want to try and reverse that. We want to try and nurse the wounds, strengthen the muscles that need that attention, that need to be addressed in this way.